Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Haitians giving up their city.
It's so huge that you need to have all organization involved, and it's quite a challenge to coordinate that correctly.
The lack of coordination in Port-au-Prince between international agencies has created two tragic migrations, a crowded bottleneck getting relief into Haiti, and a slow exodus from the city by Haitians giving up and getting out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, January 19th, and The Takeaway is trying to understand the tragic exodus from Port-au-Prince as people do give up on that nation's largest city a week after the earthquake. I'm in Washington, D.C. this morning and joined in New York by Miles O'Brien, who's in this week for Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. Let's get right to the top stories we're following for you this morning. As we've been telling you, 1 week ago today, the earth shook in Haiti, devastating the country. The staggering scope of the aftermath is now in sharper focus, with authorities estimating 200,000 dead, another 1.5 million homeless. That makes the catastrophe as about as deadly as the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami.
That is a grim milestone. And we're joined now by Gillian Dunn from the International Rescue Committee, who's in Port-au-Prince on the ground. Gillian, help us to understand this exodus. How much of an exodus are you seeing from Port-au-Prince, and where are the people going?
Yes, we are starting to see thousands of people starting to leave the city. As much as they would like to stay in their homes and near their communities and means of livelihoods, they're just finding it too difficult to do so. It's mostly people who have family in the surrounding communities, and those are the ones who have the option to go and stay with family until they can rebuild their homes.
A small fraction of the huge number of people at risk. Gillian Dunn of the International Rescue Committee, stay with us from Port-au-Prince. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Miles?
With 90% of those living in Port-au-Prince sleeping on streets, the desperation of survivors is growing with each passing day. That's the sound of Haitian police chasing away scavengers. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says aid efforts have to be sped up.
As I said the other day, the worry is till we can get ample supplies of food and water to people, there is a worry that in their desperation, some will turn to violence.
Right now, there are 1,700 U.S. troops on the ground in Haiti, with another 5,000 expected in the country this week. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wants more blue-helmeted troops on the ground.
I recommend it that the Security Council raise the number of U.N. police officers in the mission by 1,500.
Speaking in Port-au-Prince yesterday, former President Bill Clinton says if you want to help,
send us money. Send money. Because we can turn it into where it's needed and distribute it. Otherwise, if you just send goods, it's just going to be clogged up.
So far, U.S. donations for Haiti have passed $200 million. Asian markets were mixed. European indices down. Wall Street futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,609. The S&P opens at 1,136. The NASDAQ opens at 2,287.
Lots to talk about this morning. We're following that special election up in Massachusetts, where there's a lot on the line, including health care reform. The Senate seat for the late Ted Kennedy is, of course, at stake up there. And coming up, as more and more Americans are changing careers in the face of record unemployment, we're going to discuss some of the skills that every successful worker in America has, regardless of whether they're waiting tables or performing heart surgery. Beth Kobliner is on the case later on in the hour. And today we're interested in the media's coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti. The images, the stories, specifically the language of the coverage. Is what we're observing looting, for instance, or what people simply do to survive? At what point does looting become survival?
If it were your child or your mother, I don't think you'd worry about being called a looter. And I think what they show in the news and what they say, they need to put in context.
Give us your contacts at 877-8MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. It's been 1 week since the 7.0 earthquake devastated Haiti.
Have you seen any help yet?
No, not yet.
Well, we're looking. Coming up, we'll see whether or not aid has finally arrived when we check in with UNICEF's Carol Stern and Gillian Dunn, back with us from the International Rescue Committee, coming up in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone, from Washington, D.C. this morning and tomorrow. And good morning, Miles O'Brien, up there in New York, in for Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. How's it going down there?
Well, it's great, and we're going to be here for the next couple of days. And, you know, it's worth noting, it's more than worth noting, tomorrow will be 1 year since the Obama era began in America, in the world, and certainly here in this tough political town where politics is sausage and special interests and spinning wheels of power and backroom deals. It's all the stuff of Bob Woodward tell-alls and perhaps the less-than-all-telling political memoirs that come out of this city. This is just 1 year into this moment of change, the Obama era. A year ago, you may recall, the streets were packed with people conversing on the mall to see a moment, to hear a speech, to download on the bitter cold streets of the nation's capital that day some hope.
Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man, a charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake.
Towering rhetoric a year ago, a parade of jumbotrons, you remember, lined up like huge playing cards at the center of power, and Obama the dealer. The rhetoric sounded so pretty, but the sausage-making of real politics since. Tasty, perhaps, but not pretty. A year later, no one is on the streets down here in Washington except to jog in the spring-like air. It hit 60 degrees yesterday afternoon, Miles. There were the usual tourists looking for the Space Museum, you know them. Mm-hmm. There was the White House, people looking for the White House, standing in line for the tour, the veterans' memorials, lobbyists and lawmakers hurrying to and from cars, and in an irony that speaks volumes about America and about democracy and this media era, suddenly the whole Obama era may come down to a question of potholes, negative ads, and how angry some folks in Massachusetts are this morning. Then, talking to the world, today the Obama message goes out to the few in Massachusetts voting in that special election, vote number 60 in the Senate.
Think long and hard about getting in that truck with Martha's opponent. It might not take you where you want to go. And where we don't want to go right now is backwards to the same policies that got us into this mess in the first place when we just started to make progress cleaning it up.
What a difference a year makes in the rhetoric, certainly in the headlines. The campaign never referred to Massachusetts as a battleground state, and there was no mention of Haiti as the focus of the international community 1 year ago. Exploring the contrasts and changes in this short Obama year is why The Takeaway is spending today and tomorrow down here in Washington, D.C. But let's go to Haiti, which is the focus of both the international community, the Obama administration, and the relief effort, and certainly a lot of institutions here in Washington are mobilized on the Haitian relief effort. But joining us once again, Jillian Dunn, Director of Emergency Response from the International Rescue Committee. She's in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And Carol Stern is CEO and President of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. Carol Stern, let's begin with you. We talked about the exodus out of Port-au-Prince, which suggests that people are giving up on the city. What can you tell us about the state of coordination or the lack of it in the relief effort right now?
You know, I think the relief effort is as coordinated as it can possibly be, given the sense of a double disaster, what existed before and what's, you know, come afterwards. I know for UNICEF, we've had three planes get in. We yesterday doubled the number of spots we were distributing water. It may feel slow. It is slow. We wish it were quicker, but it is more than likely as fast as it possibly could have been.
Are there circumstances unique to Haiti? I'm reminded of the earthquake in China, where the Chinese infrastructure mobilized to an extraordinary degree, and the death toll there was about 100,000.
Well, you know, you start with the fact that Haiti was the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. It's been ravaged by numerous storms in the past, you know, in recent years. Before the storm, you had two doctors per 10,000 people in country, 50% of the population under the age of 18, only 54% with access to water before the earthquake hit. So you don't even have, you know, the basic infrastructure before the tragedy, and now you're faced with a place where the airport is shut down, the port gets shut down. You're behind
that's
the
still a case,
everywhere you
a week a week after that earthquake struck. That is still the case. Carol Stern is CEO and president of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. Jillian Dunn, director of emergency response for the International Rescue Committee. What do people say on the streets? If something could happen tomorrow, I want this. Or if they could just get this. What are people saying in their frustration, the ones that are staying in Port-au-Prince?
Well, their first concern, of course, is shelter. We have thousands of people who are sleeping in the open air. Towards dusk, as you go towards the city, you see thousands and thousands of people starting to lay cinder blocks across the roads and then lay sheets out onto the roads so that they can sleep there during the night. So shelter is the primary concern. The other concerns are what you would expect as far as food and water and sanitation and getting adequate health care.
And Jillian Dunn, we're talking this morning about the sensitivity of language and describing what people are doing to try to save themselves. Do you think there's an important distinction between reports of looting and a sense that people are merely trying to survive?
I think that there are always people who will take advantage of a situation like this and will start to loot and steal from their neighbors. But really, for the most part, people are very calm. They are frustrated, but they are calm. They know that we are there to help. There's no antagonism against IRC and other organizations here. But, of course, we do have concerns about the security of the population, especially those who are more vulnerable and those who are sleeping out on the streets. But overall, I would say that the situation is about what you expect from any population.
Indeed. Jillian Dunn is Director of Emergency Response for the International Rescue Committee. Thanks so much for joining us. And Carol Stern, would you agree with that assessment, that security, based on the reports you're hearing, is pretty good right now in Haiti, before we go?
Absolutely. That's what I'm hearing, exactly the same from our people on the ground, that it is calmer than people have a sense it is.
All right, to Carol Stern, CEO and President of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, talking about the difficulties and also the positives in Haiti as people wait for relief, decide on whether they're going to stay in Port-au-Prince or leave, and the sensitivity of language in describing people trying to survive versus taking matters into their own hands and taking advantage of the situation, as Jillian Dunn said there. That's on The Takeaway.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other headlines we're following. Miles?
Republican Party Chairman Michael Steele is calling today's special Senate election in Massachusetts crucial. He told CBS that Democrats who dominated politics a year ago are finding the landscape very different now. Former Democratic Party Chairman Terry McAuliffe tells CBS his party must get a healthy voter turnout to avoid an upset. And that turnout is said to be pretty strong this morning. Earlier, we spoke to David Bernstein, political commentator at the Boston Phoenix. He said Massachusetts is not as heavily Democratic as people may think. He said the popularity of the Republican contender is a backlash against national and state Democrats.
I think this has been less about specific issues than just trying to send the message about government responsiveness, and the Democrats really just didn't see it coming.
The election has a clear impact on health care reform, with the Democrats aiming to retain their 60-vote majority in the Senate. You can visit our website to read the latest analysis of the election from The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Read it at takeaway.org.
American aircraft, apparently frustrated with difficulties at the port and the airport, have been dropping relief supplies directly to survivors of the Haitian earthquake. Food and drinking water are being dropped into a secure area near the capital. The United Nations Food Program says it will need 100 million prepared meals in the next month alone. Miles?
And that's a look at our stories we're watching for you this morning. Coming up, breaking up is hard to do. The New York Times finance reporter Louise Story tells us who will get the House and who will get Triumph the Insult Comedy Dog if NBC and Conan O'Brien are to part ways, as we're told.
A huge story.
That's in just a few moments. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, our news takeouts. It's a full house here. I'm down in Washington with Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John. Welcome to Washington.
And up there with you, Miles, it's Ibrahim and Louise in the studio, right?
We miss you. We miss you.
All right. It's the whole takeout family. Let's begin with Todd Zwillick. The headline this morning out of Washington is the president may have, or has he, selected a date for the State of the Union speech.
Well, House leaders have confirmed and the White House has confirmed that January 27th, which is next week, John, will be the date of the State of the Union. It was a really strange state of affairs that we got this late in January without knowing exactly when the speech will be. And it's been a confusing state of affairs. They've been saying the whole time, the Democrats, we want to have health care done so the president can wrap it in a bow and thank Congress and present it to the public at the State of the Union.
Right.
But as we know, the health care bill wasn't done. If you want to have it done before the State of the Union, they simply didn't schedule the State of the Union. Now they've got it scheduled.
Deadlines have been slipping.
That's exactly right. And this has been a whole confusing state of affairs. And we've confirmed another thing from Congress, which is with all of the confusion in Massachusetts, will Democrats even have 60 votes in the Senate by the end of the day? All of these health care negotiations that have been going on are now in doubt. And Democrats have now been hatching a plan that's been confirmed to me that what they may have to do instead of negotiating a health care bill is simply have the House pass the Senate bill.
The Senate wouldn't have to re-vote. So there'd be no question of the 60 votes.
There'd be no question of the 60. However, the Senate bill has no public option, abortion language that the House can't stand, no tax on the rich, which the House insists on. Last week, I had a conversation with a liberal member from Massachusetts, Representative Peter Lynch from just outside Boston, about this very scenario. And listen to this prescient statement that Peter Lynch made.
If Massachusetts doesn't go the Democrats' way, one way to address that here is to have you all pass a Senate bill to avoid having to go to 60 again over there, because there wouldn't be 60.
They don't have the votes to pass the Senate bill in the House. They do not have the votes. I can guarantee that. Something has to change.
Something has to change. What's it going to be?
What's it going to be? Nobody knows. This is truly a murky state of affairs. You see a liberal Democrat from Massachusetts reflecting just how difficult to spot the Democrats are in. Now, one thing seems to be pretty clear. They're not going to have this done by the State of the Union. Primetime speech. The president can present an agenda. He's not going to be able to thank Congress for health care. He's going to have to say, we're on the precipice.
And how many Democratic senators will be in that,
exactly.
that chamber? Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Sure.
Back
thing.
To you, Miles, in the studio in New York.
Let's do some more takeout, shall we? Late night talk show host Conan O'Brien is leaving NBC. Have you heard about that a little bit?
Just a little.
Rumor has it he will tape his last show next Friday. And when he goes, he might also leave behind this popular skit.
It's premiere night here for Attack of the Clones, but outside the Ziegfeld Theater is the real show, Return of the Dorks.
Ah, yes. Triumph the Insult Dog, a recurring character on the show, Pimpbot 5000, Conando, and then there's that bear. We won't say what the bear does. 16 years worth of intellectual property. Louise Story is financial reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, this is kind of shades of what happened when Letterman left for CBS. Could he take the top 10 list, all that kind of stuff. Let's talk, first of all, about what kind of intellectual property there is that Conan might be able to take away. I'm sure it's all part of the negotiation, right?
So Conan not only has these characters who you named, but also particular skits like the Year 3000 skit. He's been on there 16 years, so of course, all of the things he's known for are property of NBC, and this has been
NBC owns it all?
That's typically how these things work, but you negotiate over it, and apparently this was a big part of their negotiations. You know, he's leaving with some $40 million.
But is it really have any value to anybody else?
Well, that's the funny thing. You know, it's hard to imagine these skits without Conan.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes when networks keep these characters, it's a little bit of kind of a, goodbye to you. We're not giving you your characters.
I mean, you know, it's
but
not
wouldn't
like
you love to see Brian Williams do Pimpbot 5000?
I'm not sure that would work. You know, when Letterman left NBC to go to CBS back in the early 90s, there was a similar fight. He lost the ability to take some of his skits with him, but he simply renamed them. So viewer mail became the CBS mailbag. And the character Larry Bud Melman, that actor kept coming on, but he came on under his real name, Calvert DeForest. And, you know, the top 10 list got renamed the Late Show top 10 list. So you might see something like that with Conan.
There
was a funny, I don't know if you remember, when Letterman first went on CBS, there was a funny skit where Tom Brokaw came on from NBC. And he came on and he went over and he grabbed the cue cards and said, oh, sorry, these are property of NBC. And then Letterman said, well, legally, I can continue to call myself Dave. So I'm sure there'll be humor around this.
He checked with his lawyers. All right, Louis Story, thank you very much. We'll be watching that development unfold because the saga continues in late night TV.
Apparently NBC doesn't want to own Conan's hair, I guess. our last takeout, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. There is a new star in the NBA, and it's not in the East. It's in the West. Ibrahim, where should we look at the NBA right now?
Well, if you paid attention to any of the basketball on during the Martin Luther King Day, Oklahoma City, which formerly was the Seattle Supersonics, was playing the Atlanta Hawks. And now it's a battle of teams that are sort of lower top-tier teams in the NBA. But the key player on the Oklahoma City is a guy named Kevin Durant. He's 21 years old. He was a 2007 Rookie of the Year. He averages 28 points per game. He's 6'9 with a 7-foot, 5-inch wingspan. He is the next star of the NBA.
Incredible. And where did Durant come from?
He was a star at Texas. He played there for 1 year. Now he jumped to the NBA. But let's not forget about college basketball right now, because Texas and Kentucky, up until last night, Texas was undefeated with Kentucky. And then last night, Kansas State beat Texas in a thriller where some of their top players were reduced to rubble underneath the Kansas State pressure. It was a really amazing game. But now you have Kentucky that will be the only undefeated team in college basketball. So the college basketball game is heating up right now.
Wow, well, there are two takeaways, Kentucky and Kevin Durant, who also entered the NBA straight out of college without graduating, right?
Correct. He was a freshman and then he went straight
Ibrahim
to the NBA.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. Those are your takeouts.
There we go.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is going to talk to us about the Haitian recovery efforts that HHS is involved in and also healthcare reform. That's in just a few minutes. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. 1 week since the earthquake in Haiti, the European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and 1.5 million homeless. Thousands of Haitians are fleeing the city of Port-au-Prince, heading to the countryside in search of food, water, and shelter on their own. Many left behind are facing increased desperation. You're listening to the sound of Haitian police chasing away a crowd breaking into a store. Nevertheless, the U.S. military says the security situation overall is stable. According to Rear Admiral Mike Rogers, aid distribution and search and rescue missions are possible still.
We have seen nothing that suggests to us that we have widespread disorder, no sense of widespread panic.
Meanwhile, French President Nicolas Sarkozy has moved to head off reports of a dispute with Washington over the relief efforts in Haiti. He issued a statement welcoming what he called the exceptional mobilization of U.S. forces. Yesterday, a French minister said America's role in the relief effort should be about helping Haiti, not, quote, occupying it.
Here at home, the polls are open in Massachusetts, where we're following today's special Senate election. Democrat Martha Coakley is running neck and neck with Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. Overseas this morning, Google postponed the launch of its mobile phone in China, adding to the potential fallout of its dispute with Beijing over internet censorship and email hacking. Two big business stories this morning. Japan Airlines, the biggest airline in Asia, filed for bankruptcy. And Cadbury, the British candy maker, has accepted Kraft's takeover offer worth nearly $19 billion, potentially creating the world's largest maker of chocolate and candy. The S&P opens at 1,136, the Dow 10,609, the NASDAQ at 2,287. Those are some of the news stories we're watching for you this morning.
We go live now to U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. She has some of the responsibility for providing medical care and aiding relief efforts in Haiti, the details of which we spoke about there in the headlines. Good morning, Secretary Sebelius.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. One question right off the bat. Since HHS traditionally is responsible for the health of Americans, I was surprised to learn that you had a large and significant role in the Haitian relief effort.
Well, the way the sort of government relief effort is structured, even internationally, is that HHS has one of the leads in the public health response, and also our Centers for Disease Control personnel are on the ground helping to secure and look at the safe water and food supply. So we kind of have a dual role, along with lots of partners. John, this is an incredible international effort with under UN umbrella, lots of countries and about 30 nations and hundreds of NGOs who are involved. So the U.S. is part of that very massive operation.
Are you hearing from your teams on the ground some of the reports that we're hearing of difficulty coordinating, of a need for some central authority, and the UN sort of reeling from the effects of the earthquake last week, and the Haitian government maybe not being as tough or as strong as it needs to be?
Well, I think there's no question this is an enormously difficult environment. The logistics are difficult. A lot of the infrastructure was destroyed, and some of the infrastructure wasn't terribly robust to begin with. So just landing planes and unloading them has been, I think, a significant challenge. Getting enough housing for the people who want to help, food and water has been pouring into the country and more every day, but getting that distributed. So each of those kind of challenges along the way, I think the good news is things are getting better. There's definitely a coordinated effort. The UN has had their biggest loss of life in UN history with the direct hit on their headquarters. So there are lots of folks who are really struggling in this environment.
You know, we are hearing conflicting reports on whether the U.S. is allowing seriously injured Haitians to be transferred to, say, Miami and other cities on the Gulf for surgery and treatment. What can you say about U.S. policy, if there is one, and shouldn't the U.S. medical infrastructure, robust as it is, be offered to the Haitians here?
I'm not sure I can speak very effectively to the transfer. I think the goal has been, John, to get the people on the ground to actually treat folks. As you know, moving people is not necessarily the best idea. So not only are there, we have now 265 medical personnel on the ground, including surgical teams and medical teams. There are hospital facilities being set up in five different areas. There's a hospital ship that is about to be operational with many more additional facilities. So I think the focus has been how we get personnel as quickly into country and operational as fast as possible. Over 1,000 patients have been seen in the last 2 days, and that's a real step forward and very good news.
Indeed. If I'm a family in Port-au-Prince and making the difficult decision to either give up on the city and maybe go out in the countryside and fend for myself or stay and wait it out, what would your message to me and other families like me be?
Well, I would think that the efforts to get and food, water, shelter are, as I say, more robust every day. And so the opportunity to be taken care of in a more direct fashion is probably better if they actually stay put. I don't know what the facilities are like the further out country you get. And certainly there's a challenge with logistics. I know folks traveling from the Dominican Republic, the other side of the island, have had some serious challenges because the earthquake ramifications reached out into the countryside. But there's been a swift response. There's a coordinated civilian-led effort in this very difficult environment and distributing relief, as well as, John, one of the other functions that we're very much involved in is the American citizens, almost 45,000 American citizens who actually live in Haiti. Over 3,000 are now back in the United States, and more are arriving every day.
Well, I'm hearing there a guarded, sit-tight message from Kathleen Sebelius, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services. Before we go, this special election up in Massachusetts may hold the fate of the entire health care reform bill, which, if it does get passed, would pass to your responsibility to actually implement. Does it surprise you that this whole political battle may come down to the question of how many potholes were filled in some neighborhoods in Boston?
Well, I think around every turn there's an interesting challenge, but I'm very confident that Martha Coakley will be the next senator. On a personal basis, it's time they sent a woman to the Senate. I'm pleased with that opportunity. And, you know, we've been working hard on reconciling the House and Senate bills. About 90% of the bills are in agreement. And I'm very hopeful that having this much work over the last year been done on behalf of the American people, we will actually be able to get a bill to the president's desk in the next couple of weeks.
All right. She's hopeful. Kathleen Sebelius, thanks so much for being a part of the program. U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services watching Haiti and that special election in Massachusetts. She spoke to us here in Washington. And we're down in Washington. And today on the program, we are interested in the media's coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti. The images, the stories, and specifically the language of that coverage. Is what you're observing looting or simply what people do to survive? At what point does looting become survival? Coming up, some career advice and figuring out how to reach down deep in your real experience and figuring out if you have maybe more assets than you thought you had. Beth Kobliner has the story later in the hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry in Washington.
And I'm Miles O'Brien in New York, in for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. The BBC's interactive program, World Have Your Say, has been speaking to ordinary people in Haiti about the disastrous earthquake that took place 1 week ago. Here's an example of some of the responses the BBC has been hearing from Haiti.
We don't have no houses. Most of the houses destroyed. Even the houses stand up, people scared to sleep on them. Most of these people don't eat since Tuesday night. Thursday, 2 days after, they bring some cookies. Last night, they threw food in the street. We can't even get them.
A lot of emotion there. World Have Your Say host Roz Atkins has just returned to London after a trip to Florida, where he hosted three shows among the Haitian American community. Roz, good to have you with us. Who have you been speaking to? What have you been hearing?
Hi, Miles. Thanks for having me on The Takeaway. Well, we spent 3 days, two in Southwest Florida and the third on Friday in Little Haiti in Miami. And essentially what we were trying to do was connect Haitians living in the States with Haitians back home, or at least people in Port-au-Prince who could give them information. What unfolded was incredibly difficult for all our listeners to listen to, I think, and of course much more difficult still for the people taking part, because in those first couple of days after the earthquake took place, people just couldn't make any connection. We were having these audience shows, and on the front row would be 15, 20 Haitians all holding their mobile phones, their cell phones, texting, going through Facebook, trying to call during the program and having no luck at all. So we were able to, mainly using Skype to be honest, able to connect them with one woman called Dixie, who ran an orphanage in Port-au-Prince, another guy called Rene, who was a radio reporter, who we were able to speak to over Skype. And of course, it was a terrible thing because these Haitians in Southwest Florida and in Little Haiti wanted information. But when they got the information from Port-au-Prince, you know, much more often than not, it wasn't what they wanted to hear.
So looking for information is the obvious thing. Is my loved one, is my friend okay? Beyond that, what are the people saying in the Haitian American community?
Well, the second issue, and you're right, first and foremost, of course, people were concerned with getting hold of their loved ones. But the second issue, and this was coming out when we broadcast at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Wednesday, so this is less than 24 hours after the earthquake, they were already talking about the media. They were already angry. And in the item I was listening to just before I came on, you played that clip by Kanye West talking about the phrase looting. That's the word a lot of people have already latched onto. They feel that the developed world's media or the Western media is jumping far too quickly to suggest that all law and order is breaking down. In fact, I just before I came to see you picked up an email from a World Have You Say regular in Australia called Andrew saying, look how quickly society breaks down when cities are destroyed. But lots of Haitians are pushing back and saying, well, it's not really breaking down. Of course, we're going into shops when we need food or we need medicine, but that's not breaking down. That's just survival, to use Kanye West's words. So there is a frustration that from the off, people have been prepared to think the worst of Haiti and of Haitians when they're reacting to this terrible tragedy.
All right, Roz, thank you very much. Roz Atkins is the host of the BBC's World Have Your Say. And the takeaway question this morning is, what do you think about how the media is covering this? And is the media covering this in a way that has some racial undertones? What is the difference between looting and survival? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien in New York City, in for Celeste Headlee on vacation. John Hockenberry in Washington this morning. Coming up, as more and more Americans are changing careers in the face of record unemployment, we'll discuss some of the skills that every successful worker in America has, regardless of whether they wait tables or perform heart surgery. That story is coming up in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check of the leading stories we have for you at 47 minutes after the hour. Since the earthquake struck Haiti 1 week ago today, U.S. donations for the country have passed $200 million. And U.N. Special Envoy to Haiti, former President Bill Clinton, says things are getting better.
Aid is pouring in here. We've gone from 3 planes a day landing at the Port-au-Prince Airport to 67 planes a day.
And that number's going up. Meanwhile, aid groups say the earthquake has created tens of thousands more orphans. That's in addition to the approximately 380,000 children who are already living in orphanages in Haiti. On to other news now. Voters are heading to the polls this morning in Massachusetts in a special election to fill Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. A Republican win would eliminate the Democrats' 60-seat majority in the Senate, and that could put health care legislation at risk. You can visit our website to read the latest analysis on the election from Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Read it all at thetakeaway.org.
We're getting reports from Kabul, Afghanistan, that police are searching vehicles and increasing checkpoints a day after that brazen Taliban attack in the city center. The attack has raised concerns about the government's ability to protect the capital. Jay Leno took a few moments out to be serious, sort of, about the late night chaos at NBC.
So they come and they go, listen, this show isn't working. We want to let you go. Can I get out of my contract? They go, no, you're still a valuable asset to the company. How valuable can I be? You fired me twice. How valuable can I be?
Leno says NBC plans to put him back in the 11:35 slot. There are rumors Conan has said bye-bye to the NBC network. Latest business news. Citigroup has reported a $1.6 billion loss in 2009 after an $18 billion loss the year before. Fortune's improving, but not so much. Also, Japan Airlines, JAL, the largest carrier in Asia, announced bankruptcy today. And Kraft and Cadbury is another big business story this morning. For our international business segment, we're looking at a major deal between the two food giants. Earlier, we spoke with BBC business correspondent Mark Gregory from London. I asked him if the government if this agreement means an end to the drama, or whether this deal is actually going to go through now.
Well, it appears to, though it's still possible in theory that Hershey, the American company that, of course, you're very familiar with, will come up with a higher bid. But that seems pretty unlikely. So it's almost certain now that Kraft's going to get its prize. But it's been quite a fight. Essentially, Cadbury's management said to begin with that Kraft was not offering nearly enough money. They raised their offer by $2 billion and that shut the shareholders up. And they seemed like they're going to take the money.
What market does Kraft get into by acquiring Cadbury?
Cadbury, of course, is famous as a British chocolate maker, but actually what Kraft is buying is Cadbury's access to fast-growing, developing country markets. Cadbury is really big in places like India and Mexico, and the betting among many multinational companies, including Kraft, is that increasingly they're going to have to go to developing country markets in future to get their markets, as they're mainly in their established markets. It's pretty mature, not much growth. So that's why Kraft has been interested in Cadbury. It sees it as a very, very good way into the developing world. And also remember, by joining forces with Cadbury, Kraft now becomes the world's largest chocolate and candy maker.
And in the Kraft empire, a biscuit is now a cookie. BBC business correspondent Mark Gregory, thanks so much for that.
If you're out of work and looking for a job, you are learning about a changing economy and how you might fit into it or not in a new way. And if you look long and hard enough at your own skill set, you may find you can do many more things than you first thought. UCLA professor Mike Rose has taken a look at this and is out with a book, The Mind at Work, which may help you recognize some talent and experience you might take for granted. For this week's work segment, we're talking with him as well as with our trusty work contributor, Beth Kobliner, who is also the author of a book. Hers is Get a Financial Life. Good to have you both with us. Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Beth.
Hi.
Hi there.
Mike, you got this idea, as I understand it, for the book from your late mother, who happened to be a waitress, and her skills you felt were transferable to a career which you might not predict. Tell us about that.
Well, Miles, I grew up in a working-class family. You know, my uncles were machinists. My mother was a waitress. A lot of folks worked in factories. And I just always had the sense that these folks were smart people. And I undertook this project to try and demonstrate all the intelligence involved in the kinds of blue-collar work that we were just talking about. So my mother, for example, I mean, she was very adept at remembering things. She was really good at taking in a room at a glance and knowing what was going right and what wasn't going right. She was great at prioritizing things that would fly at her, right, and be able to move about a busy restaurant. She was really good at reading people. I mean, those are pretty impressive intellectual skills.
And you're multitasking if you're a waitress. There's a lot of things you have to do to make that work. I guess, Beth, let's bring you in on this. How do you turn that into something that is sort of saleable on a resume?
Right.
It's sometimes hard to explain this if you're applying for a job that's completely far afield.
Right. Well, first off, you know, as we said, unemployment right now is at 10%, but blue-collar workers have been especially hard hit, and we have to say that. You know, everybody knows about closing of factories, but if you look at specific jobs, as of December, the highest unemployment rate is among construction workers, with a rate of more than 22%. But that group, and because of the economy, you want to be more nimble. And one example would be conventional thinking is blue-collar workers usually don't have resumes. You know, the last 20 years, that was not something they do. So more and more, there was an article in the Chicago Times about how they are starting to put together resumes and put things on resumes, such as did more customer interaction or developed. Mike has a great example in his book about his uncle developed a product as a paint sprayer, which then went on to save the company money. So really having targeted resumes that can help you get other jobs, perhaps in the same field or other fields.
The expression is you need to toot your own horn a little bit, and this is important, and it's also important, Dr. Rose, to know what to toot. And what would you suggest to viewers, sort of a takeaway for them, on how they would go through this self-examination and see these talents and skills?
Well, I think one thing you would do would be to sit down and really ask yourself the kinds of questions that you and Beth are raising right now. What really did I do on that job that I just had? You know, what were the kinds of things that I had to do every day and had to do well? What kinds of intellectual skills were involved in this? Even at first glance, if it doesn't seem like there was much there, there may be more there than you think. And then the question becomes, are these transferable to other kinds of work? Now, Miles, I want to make a point here. I don't want to be glib about this. I mean, obviously, we can't willy-nilly drop from one job to another. I'm a pretty good problem solver in the work I do, but you put me in the middle of a pulmonary clinic, and I would be, you know, pretty incompetent.
But we got the OR set up right here, Mike. We were just going to test
it out.
This
is very honest of you.
I'm on my way over, Beth.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point I do want to make is that if you have developed skills in solving problems or in prioritizing a lot that's coming at you or at reading people, then that does give you an orientation and a body of experience in being competent in those kinds of skills. And as you learn a new area, as you build a knowledge base in a new kind of work, and if someone, maybe yourself or someone there at work, can point out to you the overlap between the kinds of things you used to be able to do and what you can do now, then I think that gives you a real advantage.
All right, and Beth, just quickly, what's easier? Which direction? Blue collar to white collar, white collar to blue collar?
I think it's tricky, but I liked what Mike talked to me about once, that, you know, a hair cutter. You think, oh, it's a hair cutter. But he said, people go into a hair cutter and say, you know what, I want a summery look. You know, I would be like, what the heck does that mean? But a good hair cutter knows what a summery look means, taking the abstract to concrete. And I think understanding you have that skill will take you a long way when you're putting that on your resume.
Thank you, Beth Koblenzer, regular Takeaway contributor here in the studio, and also Mike Rose, professor of education at UCLA and the author of The Mind at Work. We appreciate your time.
Thanks. I mean, knowing the value of what a summary look looks like, I love that. That's fantastic. Today we're interested in the media's coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti, the images, the stories, specifically the language, what people do to survive. At what point does looting, for instance, become survival?
a lot of the language that is being used to refer to the tragedy in Haiti is laced with racism, and very similar to what happened with Hurricane Katrina, and this is really counterproductive.
All right, you can give us your context and critique our language or any of the language of the coverage at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website at thetakeaway.org. In something quite different, Todd Zwillick's analysis of the Senate election underway in Massachusetts right now is unfolding on our website at thetakeaway.org. That's where you can find his comments. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Miles O'Brien. This is The Takeaway. In Massachusetts, the voting is now underway. The names on the ballot are Brown and Coakley, but they might as well be Obama and healthcare. The stakes are high and the rhetoric is white hot.
I know I'm not Ted Kennedy. Nobody is.
Just run a positive, healthy, upbeat, straightforward, issues-oriented campaign. And that's what I've done.
He's totally wrong. Just because you're driving a truck around Massachusetts doesn't mean you're going in the right direction.
You can criticize my record. You can talk about the positions I have. But don't ever start criticizing my truck.
Could the Democrats' agenda really all end with the election to succeed the late Ted Kennedy? Irony you can't make up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. It's Tuesday, January 19th. I'm Miles O'Brien in New York for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. I'm joined by John Hockenberry in Washington. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Miles. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. A week after the earth shook in Haiti, the numbers coming in are staggering. The European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and another 1.5 million homeless. That makes the catastrophe about as deadly as the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. 90% of the survivors in Port-au-Prince are still sleeping in the streets.
We don't have no houses. Most of the houses destroyed. Even the houses stand up, people are scared to sleep on them.
For that reason, among others, thousands are now fleeing the city. Earlier, we spoke to Carol Stern, the CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, about the pace of aid into the country.
It may feel slow. It is slow. We wish it were quicker, but it is more than likely as fast as it possibly could have been.
Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, meanwhile, told us this morning that her department is playing an important role on the ground.
HHS has one of the leads in the public health response, and also our Centers for Disease Control personnel are on the ground helping to secure and look at the safe water and food supplies.
The aid is flowing in, but Haitian singer Wyclef Jean has this reminder.
For every success story you see, there's another 40,000 that's been buried.
So far, U.S. donations for Haiti have passed $200 million.
Here at home, the polls are now open in the special Senate election in Massachusetts. It's a too-close-to-call race between Democrat Martha Coakley and Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. Joining us once again, Jared Bowen, a reporter for the Greater Boston and our partner station WGBH. Jared, earlier this morning, you were with us at the Cathedral High School in Boston's South End neighborhood. It seemed as if turnout was going to be high. Is that still the case?
It is. I think everybody's trying to get out before work, and also we're in the midst of a snowstorm, so I think that has probably changed things dramatically. People were certainly lined up a lot stronger than I even anticipated. That's even with the Secretary of the Commonwealth's forecast within the past few days that turnout was going to be high based on just absentee ballots. But now with the snowstorm, it remains to be seen how the vote's going to turn out for the rest of the day.
What is the conventional wisdom about how turnout favors one candidate or the other?
Well, I think, especially with the snowstorm, it's easier for people in the city to vote, and that's going to help Martha Coakley. She really needs to get out the vote here in Suffolk County, which is the Boston area. And, of course, the Democrats have had a really powerful machine here in Massachusetts for a very long time, of course, orchestrated in large part by Senator Kennedy. This is Scott Brown's first major campaign, and the Republicans have been weak in Massachusetts for several years, although you certainly wouldn't see that from the last week and what they've been able to pull together.
Thanks very much. Jared Bowen, reporter for the Greater Boston, our partner station WGBH carries that. We'll talk more about that election in just a moment. John.
A couple of economic stories. Japan Airlines files for bankruptcy. Citigroup Group announced its second consecutive yearly loss. The bank lost $1.5 billion in 2009. Asian markets were mixed. European indices are down. Wall Street futures are mixed. The Dow will get underway at 10,609. The S&P opens at 1,136 in about a half an hour, and the Nasdaq opens at 2,287. We're interested in the media's coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti. We're going to talk about it later. But what do you think of the language of that coverage? When is looting appropriate or simply survival? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry, down here in Washington, D.C., here with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. And this town, Todd, myself, Miles, we're all watching that same political drama in Massachusetts, aren't we?
Yeah, Tip O'Neill said all politics is local. Maybe not in this case. Listen to this.
We will continue the tremendous work of Ted Kennedy. I know I'm not Ted Kennedy. Nobody is. But we are certainly not sending Scott Brown down in that seat.
That's Democrat Martha Coakley. Massachusetts voters head to the polls today to vote for the senator who will fill Ted Kennedy's seat. And their vote for either Democratic candidate Martha Coakley or Republican Scott Brown could make or break the passage of Kennedy's dream, health care legislation. David Bernstein is a political reporter and columnist at the Boston Phoenix. His column is called Talking Politics. And also, as previously mentioned by John, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. David, let's begin with you. This is an awfully close race. How did this get so close, and what's the thinking today with the prospect of heavy turnout?
Well, it does look like it's going to be quite heavy turnout. The initial things I'm hearing are that people are showing up even though the weather is not expected to be too great today across the state. But it got this way because this is not as heavily Democratic a state as a lot of people assume, and the backlash against both the national Democrats and the statewide Democrats has left a lot of people in sort of a grumpy mood, if you will. And I think this has been less about specific issues than just trying to send a message about government responsiveness, and the Democrats really just didn't see it coming. They took this general election for granted and let this all sneak up on them. And as a result, the Republican, Scott Brown, has been able to define the race to his advantage.
Is that the story of this election, that Democrats took it for granted, or is this truly a litmus test that Massachusetts voters are sort of relishing, giving the entire country?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. I think that that there's no question that Democratic voters here in the state are sending a message. And again, it has a lot to do with what's happening here in the state, which is also, you know, any problems here in the state are blamed on the Democrats who are in control of government. And at the national level, the same is true. So that's there. And the Democrats, in turn, have taken for granted their ability to win races like this and have not realized that they need to frame this election and other elections this year in those terms. They need to combat that problem in a straightforward, aggressive manner rather than trying to respond after the Republican defines the race to that advantage.
All right. Let's bring Todd into this now. Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting beside John there. If the Democrats lose this seat today, that makes them not filibuster proof anymore, and that in essence ends health care legislation in the Senate. What's the plan B for Democrats? Is there a plan B?
Good morning, Miles. It doesn't necessarily end health care legislation in the Senate. There could be some legislative sleight of hand, and of course, as we've talked about earlier this week, it's also going to depend on if Scott Brown wins, when he's actually sworn in. They have 60 until he's sworn in, so you can digest that and digest some potential delay tactics.
But well, imagine the hue and cry if they tried to sneak the vote in this kind of, you know, almost like a recess appointment kind of thing.
But imagine the Democratic tragedy if health care fails. The downside of losing Barack Obama's number one agenda item is way worse than the hue and cry on Fox News.
Know. Railroading health care reform by delaying the swearing in, that could end up killing Obama in 2012.
I'm not saying it would be good, John, but having his number one agenda item fail is way worse quicker, I
what,
think.
What about the midterm elections, much less 2012? This is going to have a lot of impact there as well.
It's true. 2010 is a big deal, but in the Senate, you know, this idea of 60, it's important. And if Martha Coakley loses this race, it will be a major political defeat for Barack Obama. There's no question about it. But this idea that going from 60 to 59 debilitates Obama's agenda in the Senate is really not true. And just very quickly, look at global warming. Look at immigration. Look at a Wall Street crackdown, regulatory reform. These are all the big things the Democrats say they want to do this year. The big hard stuff, not the little stuff. You know, immigration, the big stuff. Miles, there's not 60 votes for any of these things now. Democrats are not voting in unison. The last time they tried immigration, it failed. It failed to get 60. It failed by 14 votes. And the dynamics haven't changed all that much. There are moderate to conservative Democrats across the Midwest, Democrats who are not voting for a global warming bill as it is now. So going from 60 to 59, while it is a major political defeat, it's not like it debilitates Obama's agenda. His agenda in the Senate was never that strong to begin with.
David, let's talk about Massachusetts voters. I think those of us on the outside are looking at this thinking they're thinking about healthcare and the Obama first year. Is that really what's on their mind today?
Well, I think that that is a big piece of it. But I think that John is right in a lot of ways about the difficulties that the national Democrats face. And it's on healthcare and it's on other issues. But it's playing out here in Massachusetts where the folks who are on the right, center to right, it's very easy for them to be against whatever the Democrats are doing. But on the left, the base on the left is not in lockstep happy with what's happening in Washington. Many of
them... You're talking about because of all the compromises in healthcare legislation?
Well, it's on both sides. You've got a lot of progressives who are exactly... That's exactly right. They're unhappy with the compromises that have been made on healthcare in specific, but also on some other things, slow movement on some gay rights issues, on Guantanamo Bay and so forth. But then you've also got more centrist Democrats here in the Bay State who think that Washington is too liberal. So when you're in power, it's easy to be split on your side because you're actually doing things, whereas the base on the other side are much more united in their opposition.
Todd, just briefly as we go away here, I know the president finally set the date for the State of the Union next Wednesday. I think he was hoping to have this sort of wrapped up beforehand. What's he going to say?
Well, I don't know what he's going to say, but I can tell you this. If Martha Coakley and the Democrats lose this race, they're going to rewrite that speech. It's going to be a very different message to the American people and to Congress if he's repudiated than it would have been than the speech they thought they were going to give 3 weeks ago.
All right. Safe to say that. David Bernstein, who is a reporter with the Boston Phoenix, Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks. Let's check the stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Well, Miles, in Haiti, the United Nations is defending its earthquake relief effort. A spokeswoman says coordination on the ground is now working well. She also paid tribute to the U.S. relief effort, saying the airport in Port-au-Prince would not be working at all without U.S. assistance. Meanwhile, aid to quake victims is slowly increasing, though relief workers say pockets of violence in the capital are an obstacle. Rear Admiral Mike Rogers of the Joint Task Force in Haiti says security problems are isolated.
We have seen nothing that suggests to us that we have widespread disorder, no sense of widespread panic.
An interesting and scary report this morning in the Washington Post. It says the Justice Department is expected to explain how the FBI illegally collected thousands of U.S. telephone records during the Bush administration. Post says the FBI proclaimed non-existent terrorism emergencies to illegally gather phone records. We've been talking about the NBC story this morning. Last night on his show, Jay Leno poked fun at the network drama that would move him out of prime time.
Remember the more innocent days of late night TV when the only thing people cared about was which intern the host was nailing? What happened there?
Leno will likely move back to the 11:35 slot. And finally, the biggest airline in Asia, Japan Airlines, has filed for bankruptcy protection in one of the biggest corporate failures in Japanese history. The government says flights will continue as normal. Shares in Japan Airlines fell to an all-time low, valuing the entire company at roughly the cost of a single new Boeing 747 jet.
I could buy it.
Write him a check.
Maybe.
And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, our friend Peter Morrissey tells us about Citigroup's $7.6 billion loss during the final 3 months of 2009. That's in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So our first news takeout this morning comes from the man himself. There we go. Peter Morrissey joins us, an economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, to talk about Citigroup announcing its earnings a little over an hour ago. It ended a three-quarter profit streak with a $7.6 billion loss during the final 3 months of 2009. And Peter Morrissey, I don't know if inviting you on the program is piling on to Citibank or if we're going to actually get to the bottom of this here. Good morning.
Well, it's not hard to get to the bottom of this. I told your listeners a year ago and before that that until you get rid of Vikram Pandit, you're just not going to solve the problems of Citigroup. He still has on the board a man named Armstrong, who was his director of risk management during the great debacle. He doesn't get rid of the managers that caused the mess, and he still, well, he pays himself nothing. He pays himself a dollar because the government insists on it, which is more than he's worth, by the way.
Well, Vikram Pandit, of course, the CEO of Citibank. Let's talk about his management decisions here.
But, I mean, he's still paying He's still paying huge bonuses over there.
Right. Okay. Well, before we talk about the bonuses for a second, he tried to pay back, or he actually succeeded in paying back the government and the Troubled Asset Relief Program. But do you think that was a good decision, since much of this loss seems to come from the amount of debt he had to acquire to actually pay back the loans?
Well, the New York Times portrays it that way, which is a very sympathetic paper to the administration. I would suggest to you that you can't get around the fact that the losses were made on bad securities that they created and bought and sold, and on bad consumer loans. Portraying it as related to the TARP is rather tricky business in my mind. The bottom line here is that they made bad loans, they're writing them down, it's required to pay off the TARP, but it would have been required anyway. So let's not blame paying off the TARP.
All right, well, let's look at the taxpayers. Say it again?
They don't know how to bank. They make loans that don't get repaid, and they create securities that they go bust.
Got it. All right, taxpayers still own, by my estimate here, about $7.7 billion in Citigroup shares, stock shares.
Yep.
Now, since the bank has not been restored to profitability in his second year of being in this top job, what's that stock worth?
Well, it's probably still worth quite a bit if we can get in there and deal with Citigroup as we said we would. You know, the government wants resolution authority for future crises to break up groups like Citibank, but it's got control of this one and doesn't break it up, which just goes to show you how hollow Mr. Geithner's promises are and how hollow his financial service reforms are. My feeling is that Citigroup has got very good businesses. For example, it has a payment system that's used around the world that's integrated with its basic banking business. My feeling is that's worth a lot of money. If you just basically cleaned up the bank's bad debts and then sold off the bank, you probably get that for the payment scheme. Unfortunately, it would be likely to go to a foreign bank. You certainly wouldn't want to give it to Goldman Sachs. They would find a way to trade on it and abuse it.
All right, well, let's look at the bonus issue that you raised earlier. This is another thing that puzzles me. Technically, Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citigroup, has paid back the TARP funds, but because the taxpayers are so, underwater with the stock.
Huge amounts of, wait a minute, he's repaid
why can,
the
how can they still pay bonuses?
There's two kinds of TARP money. There's the borrowed money and there's the investment money. He's repaid the borrowed money. He hasn't even paid the revestment money. That's why we still own shares. Again, he's very good at manipulating through the New York Times and others how you understand what he's doing. He lost money not because he repaid back the TARP, but because he made bad loans, and he still has TARP money in his grasp because the government invested directly in the company and used TARP money to do that.
All right. Peter Morrissey, an economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, and not likely to be an employee anytime soon at Citigroup. Peter Morrissey, thanks so much.
No bonus for him. Our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. Our coverage of the earthquake in Haiti has sparked responses from listeners on everything from how to help to who should pay. And after our family segment yesterday, we got this from Jeffrey in Lansing, Michigan. He called 877-8-MY-TAKE to say he's surprised teachers don't talk about Haiti in schools.
I asked my young nephew, he's about 12 years old, I imagine you've been talking about the tragedy in Haiti at school. And he said, no. And I said, well, you mean not one teacher has brought up what's going on in Haiti right now? And he said, no, a couple of kids talk about it in the lunchroom, but that's about it.
Well, it may be a difficult conversation, but if done right, as we spoke about earlier this week, it can encourage kids to direct their anxiety in a positive way. They could raise money in school, selling cookies, selling lemonade, choose a charity to send the money to, even if it's a very small amount. But with all the money being donated, the question of accountability comes up. And Nick from Cliffside Park in New Jersey says that while we should all donate as much as we can,
it has to be in the context of some kind of military or policing power that just overrides the local, quote, authorities and makes sure that none of this aid is ripped off or diverted by the rich and the powerful, because they don't really care about the poor there. They never have.
Well, the motivations for the relief effort and the kinds of money going to Haiti is one story you're responding to, but also we're interested in the media's coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti, the images, the stories, specifically the language of that coverage, and what we're observing. Is it looting or is it simply survival? One caller, Larry, thinks the difference is pretty black and white.
Taking food and medical supplies is survival. Taking TV sets and DVD players is looting. Simple.
Valerie says that the lines are a little more blurry than that, though.
The goods that are in these buildings are no good to anyone because the goods are going to be crushed with the rest of the building, so it's better useful for them to have it, and I don't call it looting. I call it getting what you need when you have no other resource.
And this came to us from our website, where you can post your comments at thetakeaway.org. The police should be helping the people, not shooting them. People ran from their homes without money or possessions, nothing. Who began calling attempts to survive looting?
And if you can sell a television for food, is that looting? It's an interesting issue. The real looting is going on by the people who are not distributing the relief goods at the airport. One person writes, all these great brains can't figure out a way to get relief packages to the people. People are giving to help without food and water right now, not to rebuild the same old as before. What do you think about what's happening in Haiti? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, since the earthquake in Haiti, Americans have been flooded with images of the destruction and human devastation.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, provocative images from Haiti, in context or out of context. What does the media do well or poorly in a situation like this? We're going to discuss that in just a moment. Right now, let's check out the top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. It was a week ago today when the ground shook in Haiti. The European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and another 1.5 million homeless. Survivors are streaming out of the capital of Port-au-Prince, and those who stay are facing increasing desperation. And they're hearing sounds like this. Haitian police chasing away a crowd that was breaking into a store in Port-au-Prince. Rear Admiral Mike Rogers, the director of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says aid distribution is still possible, though.
We want to keep doing faster and do more, but there's nothing in the security environment right now that is significantly inhibiting our ability to execute those missions.
Broadening the relief effort, a group of international creditors is calling this morning for nations owed money by Haiti to cancel their debts.
Here at home, the polls are open in Massachusetts, where Democrat Martha Coakley is running neck and neck with Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. The health care bill may hang in the balance because Democrats need that seat to avoid a filibuster in the Senate. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, says Democrats are scrambling for a way to salvage their hard-fought health care package. In case Brown wins,
Democrats have now been hatching a plan that's been confirmed to me that what they may have to do instead of negotiating a health care bill is simply have the House pass the Senate bill.
If that happens, President Obama could sign it into law without another Senate vote needed. Two big business stories this morning. Japan Airlines, the biggest airline in Asia, filed for bankruptcy this morning. And Cadbury, the British candy maker, has accepted Kraft's offer. Worth nearly $19 billion, potentially creating the world's largest maker of chocolate and candy. Those are some of the news stories we're watching for you this morning.
Think of the language of the coverage of the disaster in Haiti. Words like desperation, lawlessness, violence, charged words like looting. But what about, hey, what would you do if you were in the same situation? Listen.
What about the fact that if it's your child or your mother, what would you do? Wouldn't you go in and grab water for diapers? They say looting. They don't even describe the context. They don't even describe if a person walked out with a few things they really needed or if they just ravaged a store.
Well, you can register your comment at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. Our listener raises an important issue. It's an issue of language and also the images that are coming out of this 24-hour news cycle. Images also on the front page of newspapers all over the United States. Listen to this. Wolf Blitzer here is talking about some video he's about to show. And it's always seemed to me that when a news anchor says, this is graphic, this is a graphic image here, that maybe they actually want you to actually see the video. Listen to this.
Earlier today, CNN's crews witnessed the looting of a store in Port-au-Prince. Young men, many of them armed, took boxes of candles, then sold them on the street. The video we're going to be showing you is very graphic. Young people perhaps shouldn't see this video.
It's from CNN, of course. Do they really not want you to see the video? And does a picture of an event where a store is being ravaged by people in Haiti, does it represent simply one image out of context? Or is it representative of what you're likely to conclude as a trend throughout the country? Here to talk about the coverage and the difficulties and pitfalls of covering a disaster like the earthquake in Haiti is Natalie Hopkinson, media and culture critic for The Root. She joins us from her home here in Washington. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning.
And Philip Kennicott is Washington Post culture critic, also on the line from his home in D.C. Philip, good morning.
Good morning.
In general, Natalie and Philip, let's begin with how would you assess the coverage and what sort of pitfalls have we embraced or avoided in your view of what's gone on in the past week? Natalie?
Well, you know, I have to say I agree with the caller about the looting issue because it has become a very charged, value-laden description. And, you know, the sheer number of images that are coming out have an impact on viewers that, you know, we probably are only beginning to understand. And I think that in Philip's excellent essay in the Post about the media images, some of the standards that usually accompany you know, what kinds of images are allowed to be published have been loosened. And, you know, and I do wonder about what the impact of that is.
Philip, you know, I sometimes sense that the media follows a certain kind of script. In the beginning, it's what did it look like? Then it's the survivor stories. And then finally, it becomes the focus on security. And in each case, it's a distortion of what's actually going on. What's your impression?
Well, I think you're right with that. In the very beginning, I was struck by how graphic the first images coming out were. And that's not just the photographers in the field. That's a series of decisions that are made up and down the chain of a news organization. And it did seem to me as if, for some reason, with Haiti, the standards were changing for what newspapers in particular were willing to show. I think as time goes on, the coverage only gets in many ways worse and worse, especially as you see the large sort of television and cable news organizations there, because they look for very, very well-patterned narratives. They look for survival stories, and they look for social violence stories, and they tend to find them because all of that is happening.
Right.
But I trust the coverage in a way less and less the longer the larger news organizations are there.
You know, that's interesting. And you know, even the language is distorted here. I mean, Natalie Hopkinson, suddenly there's lawlessness. Well, there's no sudden lawlessness in a place like Haiti. They've been struggling with lawlessness for generations. And secondly, suddenly there's violence. Isn't an earthquake violence, Natalie?
It very much is violent. And, you know, lawlessness, I mean, the government buildings have been demolished. So, you know, there would be a little bit of a challenge with the law. There are police officers who don't even have uniforms to put on. Many of them are searching for their family. And it is very much a struggle for survival. And, you know, if you call that lawless, it really does conjure up a lot in many viewers who are used to seeing images out of the developing world. You know, it connotes that they're behaving less than honorably. And, you know, when, you know, in fact, people are just trying to survive.
Natalie Hopkinson is media and culture critic for The Root, and Philip Kennicott is Washington Post culture critic. You're both under the same media umbrella, working for essentially the same organization. How has the rapidly changing media environment, Philip Kennicott, changed the narrative for this disaster, do you think?
Well, for one, with the Internet, of course, we can really find the images we're looking for, no matter how graphic or tame they are. The other is competition. And
well, let's stop there. That's an interesting point. So people can surf for dead bodies.
Right. So I don't think that you know, the old gatekeeping function obviously has changed a lot. People will look for and find almost anything out there. So the self-censoring that the media used to practice isn't really nearly as enforced as it was.
Oh, that's a really interesting point. How do you think that affects the priorities of network organizations who bring enormous amounts of resources into a place like Haiti to cover it before we go?
Well, I sense, looking at the television footage, that they are looking for more dramatic. They are inserting their anchors into the events as participants to give it kind of more dramatic life. I think they're crossing boundaries that we haven't really seen, boundaries that were suggested by Katrina, but are really, you know, kind of a new way of approaching this is taking form now.
Well, lots to think about there. Philip Kennicott is the Washington Post culture critic, and Natalie Hopkinson, media and culture critic for The Root, both talking about coverage of the Haitian disaster. And, you know, we needn't just rely on two culture critics or media critics. We want to get you involved in all this. Who have you seen injecting themselves into the narrative of the Haitian disaster, and does it help you or hurt you in understanding the story? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can go to our website at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to take a different look at Haiti's aftermath through the musical voices of Haiti. It has a diverse heritage and vibrant culture expressed through its music. Stay tuned for that. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in Washington.
And I'm Miles O'Brien in New York, in for Celeste Headlee this week. In Connecticut, a horrific triple murder of a family is turning into a test of the death penalty. Only the father of this family, Dr. William Pettit, survived. His wife and two daughters were brutally murdered in one of the most savage crimes in state history. Joining us is Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist and host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, good to have you with us. How has this affected people in Connecticut?
Well, I mean, it's almost as though it's the only murder that has taken place in Connecticut in the last two or three years. I mean, there are maybe about 30 murders in Hartford every year. I can pretty well guarantee you the average person doesn't know the name of any of the victims or the circumstances of the crime. People tend to know quite a bit about the Pettit murders.
All right. Now, this is factored into kind of an ongoing debate in Connecticut about the death penalty. Tell us about that.
Well, in Connecticut, we're a death penalty state. We had the first execution in 45 years in New England in 2005, the execution of Michael Ross. We have 11 men on death row right now. But on the other hand, the legislature, even kind of in the teeth of the outrage over the Pettit murders, the legislature voted last year to abolish the death penalty, and the governor vetoed that bill, citing pretty much only the Pettit case as her reason.
So is it speculation? I know, but if it weren't for this case, do you think that perhaps the death penalty might have been rescinded there?
I don't know. I'd have to be able to look into the mind of M. Jody Rell, our governor, and I've never been very successful at doing that. She might have vetoed the bill anyway, but certainly this provides a dramatic reason for vetoing a bill like that.
Dr. William Pettit, the sole survivor of this horrific attack at their home in Connecticut, what's his role in this debate?
He's become very, very public. He's, understandably interested in vengeance. He is an advocate of the death penalty. He was publicly furious at the legislature for passing abolition of the death penalty. He and his sister now lead a sort of a grassroots organization supporting the Three Strikes and You're Out law.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because it does get into issues of parole and recidivism and letting criminals out in the street. Has that gotten a lot of talk in Connecticut?
Yes and no. I mean, at the time, in 2007, there was a call for, there were obviously huge defects in the system, and people felt that, you know, there was something terribly wrong with the criminal justice system. There was a huge outcry for an overhaul. Now, simultaneously with jury selection, we actually are scheduled to have this week, I think, one of the first reports on the, you know, sludgy, bureaucratic Blue Ribbon task force that's supposed to be figuring all this stuff out. The truth is almost none of the reforms have been accomplished in the last 2 years, partly, of course, because of the budget crunch. Like every other state around here, Connecticut has no money to do any of the things that were so urgently needed to be done in 2007. So there was a lot of noise, but not a whole lot of action.
Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks for your time.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry down here in Washington, D.C., and Miles O'Brien is up in New York for Celeste Headley, who's on vacation this week. Coming up, we're going to look at Haiti's diverse heritage and vibrant culture through its music, the aftermath of the earthquake through the diverse and rich music of Haiti. Marlon Malaya joins us, and anthropology and religion professor Elizabeth McAllister will be with us in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Snowing in Massachusetts as people head out to vote in the race for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. The race between Republican Scott Brown and Democrat Martha Coakley is close. In the past few days, Brown urged his constituents to head to the polls.
Make sure that you and you and you and you and you and even you guys filming, make sure you get out to vote.
They're counting votes on the Democratic side as well. President Obama has thrown his support to Democrat Martha Coakley.
On all the fights that matter to middle-class families across this Commonwealth, who is going to be on your side?
A Republican win would eliminate the Democrats' 60-seat majority in the Senate and put health care legislation potentially at risk. Our Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is analyzing the special Senate election as it unfolds. Go to thetakeaway.org.
Moving to Haiti now, the World Food Program is planning a tent camp just outside the capital for 100,000 people who have lost their homes. The European Commission estimates 1.5 million people were made homeless as a result of that earthquake a week ago. Finally, there's been angry reaction from Britain's Cadbury family. This after news the British chocolate maker had accepted a takeover bid from the American food giant Kraft. Speaking to our partner, the BBC, this morning, the great-great-granddaughter of Cadbury's founder, Felicity Loden, urged shareholders to reject the takeover.
I don't think we should give up at all. We can't sell out to a plastic cheese company. So it's a horror story.
Ooh, not so sweet there. After all-night negotiations, the management of Cadbury accepted an offer of around $19 billion from Kraft. Those are some of the news stories we're watching for you this morning.
So listen to that music, Miles. You feel that energy?
I do.
Well, there's also poignance. The name of this tune, Rebuild the House. Listen. That's Kampa music, Rebati Kela, which is the name of that song, which means rebuild the house. It's a poignant song this week in Haiti, one of the many voices of music in Haiti that both reflects and aids in communicating the terrible tragedy of the people of Haiti. Here to talk about it for the next segment in this hour is Elizabeth McAllister, who's a professor of religion at Wesleyan and author of the book Rara Vodou, Power and Performance in Haiti and Its Diaspora. She joins us from Middletown, Connecticut. Do I have that right on the title of your book, Elizabeth?
Yes, thanks. Hi, everybody. And can I just say I'd like to send my condolences out to everybody who lost people in Haiti, Haitian families, and also organizations who lost people on the ground. Just terribly sorry.
And that's an enormous audience that message goes out to. Well said. Marlon Rayo Mayaya, rapper in New York, is a second-generation Haitian. I suspect you would have some of the same message to send out as well, right, Marlon?
Definitely. As I've personally lost, you know, some relatives due to the situation back home, so I definitely say rest in peace. May their souls rest in peace, and you know, all my condolences.
How important is music in that process of condolence, in grief, in understanding the experience of Haiti right now and down through history? Elizabeth McAllister, using this latest song that we just played as an example, how important is it?
Well, it's crucial. People in the streets right now have absolutely nothing except the breath in their lungs. They've had their houses crushed, their families killed, their belongings evaporated, and they have no water, which is the really most intense and frightening thing.
And what we're hearing from the streets is that what they are doing is that they are gathering together and singing. And they're singing hymns. They're singing spiritual songs. They're singing all the hymns they know, which generally are about praising God and asking for mercy. And that's the reaction. And that's not just in isolated pockets or just among churches. That seems to be the general mass reaction of the citizenry in Port-au-Prince. And apparently at dusk is when, you know, the sort of the lights go down. I mean, the sunlight goes down. Things kind of quiet down on the streets. And then all the journalists and all my friends on the ground are tweeting or emailing, you know, we're starting to hear the singing now. So music is clearly, like, basically the only brass ring that they have to hang on to right now.
Well, you say brass ring. We're going to talk about the components of Haitian music in just a moment, but let's listen to this next cut. It's called the Tribulacion, and it describes, first of all, a different type of music and a different type of solidarity there in Port-au-Prince. Listen. Elizabeth McAllister, first of all, what are they saying in that song? And, you know, it's a very different instrumentation from the kampa music that we heard at the beginning.
From what I hear, that sounds like Jean-Daniel Beaubrun. That sounds like maybe it's a song from Boukman Experience. And they're a band influenced by, largely by voodoo music, mixed with rock. But in that particular track, they also reveal their underlying Protestant influence. That was modeled more on a Protestant hymn, believe it or not. And it's saying, you know, tribulation, tribulation, that's what we're undergoing right now.
Interesting. And, you know, you've got a mix of African rhythms, you've got French influence, a lot of European instruments in a very, very African kind of mix. Marlon Malaya, what are the tools you use to create your sound?
Well, definitely the African influence is there. I mean, the type of music that I do is hip-hop. And if you do your history on hip-hop, like me, myself, I'm an MC. And if you do the research on what an MC is, they get their vernacular or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, however they kick their stuff, through something that's originated in West Africa. You know, it's something, it was a person called the Griot. And the Griot was a person that was either a praise singer or a wandering musician or a poet. You know, these guys were considered like the repository of, you know, of oral tradition. So I'm just carrying that on, you know, on top of rhythm. You know what I mean?
And you come by it rightly. Your grandfather played in Brooklyn with Tito Puente. Your father toured in a kampa band. Let's listen to this song, Sentiment, right now, and I want to hear your response to it, Marlon.
Okay.
All right, so, you know, that's an important song using elements from the past. How do you use that to get to the sort of present tense that your music is about?
Well, actually, like, particularly that part we're listening to right now, there's a little bit of funk in it, which is also comprised of hip, which is also what hip-hop is comprised of. So it's all the blending of styles and the genres together that make the sound of hip-hop and also make the sound of kompa. Like, kompa music was also influenced by the Afro-Cuban sound. That's where you get the African drums from, the cymbals, and then you hear the claves and the keys, you know, according to, you know what I mean, the Latin music scene. So it all combines with everything we're doing, man. But this song in particular is so important because of the lyrics. What are they saying in that song? And if I could, maybe just, you know, cite a couple lines from it.
Go quick.
Okay, it's saying Haiti Cheri, like the USA has its motto and it's saying, it says God bless America. Haiti Cheri means Haiti my baby, which is basically Haiti's motto and mantra.
That's a great takeaway. Haiti my baby. Marlon Rayo Mayala, rapper in New York, second generation Haitian, helping us to hear through the window of Haitian music this hour. And Elizabeth McAllister, a professor of religion at Wesley and an author of the book Rara Voodoo, Power and Performance in Haiti and its Diaspora. Thanks to both of you. I'm dancing, Miles.
Yeah, me too. All day we've been examining the language in the media coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake as well, asking you when looting is simply is looting and what do people have to do in order to survive. This takeaway comes from Elaine in Brooklyn.
I think it's just an internalized lack of empathy for people who are going through something that if it were a different race, those words would never, ever, ever be used. You wouldn't use that word to talk about people in Israel or someone in Europe if they are getting water out of a store because there hasn't been any relief efforts in over 5 days and it's based upon survival.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.